And welcome to the Subcommittee of Transportation and Economic Development. It is Monday, March 31st, 2003. And at this time, I'm going to ask Robin Lamont to walk through some of the information that's been presented to the committee, and hopefully we'll get the rest of the committee here before we open up to take testimony.
And it's easy.
What did I say?
Right.
I sure did. You know, I was reading this right here. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Goodness sakes.
That's okay. I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Moore. I just want to let you know what the materials are, the handouts that you have in front of you today, just to, so you know what you're looking at. I had handed out a packet like this with a spreadsheet that shows the legislatively approved budget for the Department of Transportation since the close of session. All the actions that were taken, the top page is the summary, and the bottom pages are each program area. Senator Dukes had asked for this at our last public hearing. And then you have the responses to a question that was asked from at the last public hearing about the City of Sandy's transit system. The department has provided that. It's one page. And then there is a two-page handout that I had asked the department to answer some questions on passenger rail, and that is attached here. If there are further questions about these, this information, they'll be presenting this morning to clarify for you. And I think, oh, and the blue folder. I had asked the department to break down the performance measures by each of the program areas so that as you go through the programs you can you don't have to be flipping back and forth between them. So they have provided that in this folder. We can either insert them in your notebooks for you after the public hearing today in the appropriate place, or we can just leave them in these folders. But that's for your reference.
I'll leave mine in the folder. It'll be easier to get to.
Okay.
Not this here.
Then that's what I have.
Thank you, Susie Jordan. Well, I'm going to go ahead and open as a subcommittee the subcommittee, and we will begin with the rail program and Claudia Howell.
Good morning. I'm Claudia Howells. I manage the rail division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Just going back to where we were on Thursday, I'll follow up with what Lori discussed a bit in terms of what our overall mission is. Our mission, primarily drawn from state law, is to represent the customers of railroads, both passenger and freight, to ensure a safe, efficient, and reliable rail system in the state of Oregon. To that end, the Rail Division is heavily focused on safety, but we work hard to retain a viable rail freight system for the benefit of Oregon producers, and to continue to redevelop a quality rail passenger system. I'd like to refer you at this point to page 59 in our presentation document. And then I don't know if you're following along in the bigger budget books or not. It doesn't look like it, so I won't confuse things by adding more page numbers. I'm beginning to feel like I'm hauling around or I need a wheelbarrow to haul all the paper around. The rail system under our jurisdiction is made up of 24 common carrier railroads, one tourist railroad, and four rail transit operations. There are two Class 1 railroads. By definition, that means the large railroads that provide the interstate connections for Oregon industries. Over half of the rail route miles are operated by shortline railroads, a ratio that is unique in the nation and, in fact, impacts how we do our business from a regulatory standpoint. Furthermore, the shortline railroads serve over half of the 1,500 rail-served industries in Oregon. Those 1,500 rail-served industries, by the way, also fall under our jurisdiction in a limited fashion, and I'll talk about that more later. Together, the shortline railroads generate carloads equal to that generated by the Port of Portland. So there's actually quite a bit of train traffic that are coming off of those smaller railroads. Railroads operate in every Senate district, in all but two of the House districts. Within one of those House districts is climate, which also falls under our oversight program. Nearly every major city and many smaller communities have trains moving through them every day. Oregon railroads have 2,800, round numbers, rail route miles, but 3,700 track miles, all of which are inspected on a regular basis. There are 2,500 public grade crossings. Of that, 455 are separated. 853 are signalized, meaning they have active warning devices, leaving the remainder 1,200 with crossbucks or crossbucks with stop signs. All crossings in the state are inspected on a regular basis. Railroads together, including Amtrak, employ 2,600 people in Oregon. By the way, when I began doing this, the 2,600 began to be a good number for almost anything. I'm not sure why. Rail freight traffic generally, even given the current economy, continues to grow. And in some parts of the system, the increase in train traffic has been dramatic and noticeable to the public in recent years. Trains are getting longer. Rail cars are getting heavier. Railroads haul the preponderance of hazardous materials, and all of those affect the way we do our business. Moving passengers by rail is becoming increasingly important, not only in Oregon, but throughout the nation. And I will talk a little bit more about our passenger rail program later in the presentation. But I would also like to call attention to the several excursion train operations where we give additional scrutiny simply because they all are hauling passengers. Today, there's one narrow-gauge tourist train, not part of the interstate network, but that falls under our regulatory jurisdiction, and three tourist trains that operate in mixed freight traffic. We expect two more tourist train operations to begin service this summer. These are very popular attractions, and we have an obligation to make sure they are operated safely. The rail system also includes four rail transit operations, the largest, of course, being TriMet's light rail system, but also included in the four are the Portland streetcar operation, the Willamette Shore Trolley, and the Astoria Trolley, all of which fall under our rail safety and security oversight program. You've heard previously a discussion of the Washington County Commuter Rail Project. This is a project that is being managed by Washington County and TriMet and will ultimately be operated or administered by TriMet and operated by the Portland and Western Railroad. We're working with these entities to make sure this project moves forward smoothly and that freight operations will not be disrupted either now or in the future. Eventually, the commuter rail operation, like the rest of the rail system, will fall under our regulatory authority. The rail division is divided in three general areas, the two of which focus exclusively on safety. The largest section is the rail safety section, and that's in terms of FTE. It includes one manager who oversees two track inspectors, two motive power and equipment inspectors, that's the railroad term for locomotives and rail cars, one operating practice inspector, and one hazardous materials specialist. The individuals in these positions are certified by the Federal Railroad Administration to inspect for compliance with federal regulations. The section also includes two employee safety inspectors, and you may have heard me mention earlier the number of railroad employees in the state. Not all of them are operating employees, although many of them are. We have a portion of our program that I describe as being OSHA-like, in that we have responsibilities to ensure that train crews operating on the trains do so in a safe manner. You're probably familiar with train switching operations where train crews get on and off trains, and it is in those areas where we inspect to make sure that they have flat footing and that clearances on loading docks, bridges, within tunnels are adequate so that the train crews can get on and off the train safely. Finally, this section includes one FTE, which works with the four rail transit operations to ensure compliance with rail transit safety and security oversight programs. This is a program different from the FRA program. This is actually mandated by the Federal Transit Administration. It is a little bit different in that it is not regulatory, meaning it does not have a compliance component, but it is an oversight program, meaning that we work with those entities to make sure their safety and security operations are handled well. This part of the program is funded entirely by a rail fee assessed on the railroads. The amount of money that we've collected has been relatively flat for many years now, and we continue to collect well under the cap in the statute on the millage rate that we were allowed to collect. The only exception to that is we also assess a fee based on the budgetary requirements to support the rail and safety, the rail safety and security oversight program, so that the railroads do not pay for that part of the program, and that's funded by TriMet and the two other smaller entities. TriMet actually operates the Portland streetcar, so they pay for all of that. The crossing safety section includes one manager and six FTE that are engaged in regular crossing inspections, manage $4 million biennium designated for crossing improvement projects, and promote crossing safety education. The primary function, though, is to authorize the opening, closing, and alterations of any public railroad crossing in Oregon. This is a responsibility that is now very nearly 100 years old. This section also handles crossing blockage complaints that may result in a monetary penalty. Oregon's crossing program, like that of our rail safety program, is considered to be one of the best in the nation and has been most successful in reducing accidents at public grade crossings. That part of the program is funded by a 50-50 split between the rail fee and the grade crossing protection account. The grade crossing protection account has its revenue source from the highway fund. The third responsibility of the division relates to planning, development, and operation of the rail system, both passenger and freight. Now, I'm very well aware that the most visible is probably our passenger program. That part of the program produces rail-related planning documents, manages freight and passenger capital improvement projects, contracts with Amtrak and bus providers to provide the regional passenger rail service operating between Eugene and Portland, and works with communities on the development of rail systems. Through this area, we also participate in federal proceedings that govern the nation's freight railroads on behalf of Oregon producers in matters related to rail mergers, rail abandonments, and rail service issues. The Oregon Passenger Rail Advisory Council guides us in terms of our passenger rail policy. We also work with rail shippers, railroads, and railroad unions to help meet our mission. And these efforts in the planning and development area are funded from a combination of general and other fund state revenues and federal revenues as they come available. I'll also mention, because it was in our list of things that you wanted to know about, that we manage the Salem Railroad Station and 170 miles of railroad right-of-way over which we have a short line operating. And I've got some additional information if you are interested in how we compare to other states, if you would like me to proceed with that. Our program is relatively unique in the country. There's only a few states that have what would be called a consolidated program, meaning where the planning and development functions are within the same agency as the safety and crossing functions. So it's a little hard to find something comparable. Interestingly enough, the one that comes closest to our program is in North Carolina. And if you are interested in more details on that, I can provide that to you. I will note that their program is considerably bigger than ours. The department, or Washington, which is our closest program, remains divided between the DOT and the Washington Utility and Transportation Commission. Its passenger and freight rail planning and development programs are considerably larger than that in Oregon and have been funded at a higher level for many, many more years. The size and cost of Oregon's regulatory program has remained relatively the same for nearly 20 years. And as I said, because we collect that money from the railroads, we are very conscious of the economic impact on that industry. Increases in FTE approved last session addressed the need for a full-time transit safety and security specialist, which we were able to hire. The need for a second crossing signal specialist to handle additional workload. We are in the final stages of a second recruitment effort in that position. We also were able to fill a second crossing specialist who handles the projects that improve crossing or improve safety at crossings. Those are federally funded projects. We received a couple of new positions as part of our passenger rail program, lost one of them, and the other has been frozen. So we were unable to hire either position for that. We were able to hire two new clerical positions, which has helped a great deal. We have a very paper-intensive program and had struggled with one FTE clerical support and temporaries, and so we were very pleased to be able to finally fill those and appreciate this body for giving us permission to do that last session. I'll now direct you to performance measures, and I believe you have those in your blue binder organized by division. The rail division has three. I will mention that we have at the division level many more performance measures broken down so that we actually use them as an ongoing management tool. But these are the aggregated measures that operate at a high level. As you will see, well, you can't see because what you're seeing is sort of a year snapshot. The rail crossing incidents continue to be at a very low level in Oregon. We're very pleased to see that. We occasionally have blips, generally because we have one accident with a number of fatalities, and those tend to see the number of accidents or the number of incidents or the number of fatalities to go up. But for at least the last 10 to 15 years, incidents at rail crossings have been at a very good level. We've actually gone some years with no fatality, so we know that that is a goal that we can reach on a regular basis. Derailment incidents, they are broken out in three different areas for our management purposes, and so we actually track those very closely and pinpoint areas where we see increases. Obviously, those are on railroads and change from time to time based on various things that are happening within the railroad industry, but it also allows us to focus our attention when we see something that is a problem in a particular area.
Claudia, before we move away from track and equipment, how many miles of the new rail and the new grade improvements have been accomplished so far? You see it about everywhere now. These are the long rail sections, you know, and they've come in and redone a lot of it, particularly the route down the valley. I've seen some of the spurs that are getting the same type of remodeling.
Senator George, I'm not sure I can tell you exactly, but we can certainly get that information from Union Pacific. They're actually in the process of welding rail now. But we track what we pay for. We don't necessarily track what they pay for.
Now, do they get any federal help with that? Because that must be a very expensive process they're going through right now. Or they're doing this.
Chair George, they get no federal help on that.
Okay,
that's entirely out of their own pocket, if you will.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking at the performance measurements, we have a $2,000 and a $205 target. What's happened in the interim? Is that in our data here?
Not likely. It's an information I have. combined 2001, we saw a little bit of increase in all areas of derailments caused by human error, track problems, and equipment. In 2002, we saw a decrease in track-caused derailments and in equipment-caused derailments and a slight increase in human error-caused derailments.
Yes.
I was wondering if there's a correlation to track condition and derailments.
Chair George, Senator Morris, absolutely. And obviously, as we see the replacement of the 50-year-old rail in the, on the main line here, and see the replacement of the 100-year-old rail on the branch line system, absolutely the derailments go down.
Before you begin, I'm going to go ahead and open this before committee.
Finally, the and I'm sure the area where you're most curious is our passenger rail program. In 2000, we had ridership of about 120,000. We've seen a little bit of an increase the last 2 years, not as much as I think we would have liked, but I think the overall travel industry has gone down. We were able to grow at 1 to 2% a year. And some on some trains, we actually grew faster. But this is not a good time for the travel industry generally, as you probably know.
Claudia, do you track whether or not any of the derailments were in fact intentionally caused?
Chair George, we do, as do the railroads and the FRA, and if there is any indication of that, that's something that's referred directly to the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Have we had any of those in the last 3 or 4 years?
No.
Good. Okay, thank you.
We had some questions about the passenger rail ridership, at least what we show on our performance measures. I do want to emphasize that those numbers are for the services that we pay for. So within the corridor, and that's only within the corridor, that's the two trains and then the fill-in bus services that we have to augment the schedule. So that is only on our trains. That does not include any of the ridership on the Coast Starlight, even though we do know that we have passengers who use our train one way and then come back on the Starlight the other way. But we are only counting those that are within our corridor and from Eugene to Portland, if that answers that question. Some of the highlights of the last biennium in terms of the work we've been able to do, and I'll stay with the passenger program for a moment. We talked a little bit about the improvements that Union Pacific has made, which have been substantial, and we very much appreciate that. That was an issue that was causing us some on-time performance problems over the last year and a half. The track condition, particularly between Albany and Eugene, and they are even now continuing to upgrade that rail. But one effort that we paid for involved a major track improvement project through Brooklyn Yard in Northeast Portland. That was really the last of the federal money we received, surprisingly enough, under ICE-T. That, by the way, sort of finishes out all the federal funds that we had, and we have no current federal funds toward the high-speed rail program, although we're continuing to hope that we'll see something out of this session of Congress.
Well, do we have a question from Senator Duke?
Yeah, it was back on the performance measures. I was just curious. The rail ridership, you show going up about 2,500 people.
Mm-hmm.
Does that include by 2005 the addition of the Portland-Astoria line?
These numbers are only within the corridor. It does not include any of the other tributaries, if you will.
Okay.
Because that was what we've been tracking, I suppose. If we began tracking, I mean, we've got numbers that include, as an example, the connecting bus services. We don't include them in this number. We track that elsewhere. You know, the truth is we can take numbers from any of these and put them together or take them apart, depending on what people actually want to look at.
But we own all of this land around the state that rails are running on, and I was just curious how well it was being used and whether we projected increases in some of those. I mean, this wouldn't be the only short line, and maybe we don't operate it, but we're a partner in there.
Chair George, Senator Dukes, I think I need to make sure I understood the question. Are you talking about the passengers that would be on the Astoria line, combining them?
Or any of the other little lines we've got running around, where we have some involvement.
Of course, the Astoria line is the only one that we actually have a financial involvement as compared to any of the other tourist operations. We don't have any financial involvement in those. So we have not tracked those.
Do we have any other short lines around where we own the land or the rail or something?
We own the underlying right-of-way on the Astoria line and then part of what's called the Oregon Electric. But it's, frankly, a passive ownership, if you will. We have nothing to do with the actual operation of the railroad, and the railroad actually owns the operating easement and the track structure. So to the extent that we contribute, not really.
Okay, so we're only tracking Albany to...
We've been tracking the ridership. Well, we track ridership in a lot of different segments. What's in the performance measure is specific to the inner city passenger corridor between Eugene and Portland.
So it wouldn't be a goal to increase ridership in other areas of the state?
Oh, it would be. Absolutely. Absolutely. At the time these measures were done, we didn't have any funding for the Astoria project, so I don't even think that that was something we were even contemplating at the time, because these were actually set last fall. But certainly from a specific goal of corridor ridership, we track all of that and plan to. And our goal for the Astoria line is very specific. We need to pay for it. I think I was talking about a couple of highlights from efforts we made this last year. One of them, and I'll refer to this, is we completed the 2001 Oregon Rail Plan. And we do have a few copies of these left. We didn't have a lot of them printed. They're also available on the Internet if you wish to download them, which was a considerable cost savings. We also have these in CD-ROM if any of you are interested. This is essentially equivalent to the Rail Division's DIP. This has an investment plan, assuming we have funds, for improvements in both the freight and passenger system, and has quite a bit of detail about the overall rail system in addition to that. One of the things we did do this last biennium was to distribute $2 million in state funds that were authorized by this body 2 years ago. We distributed that money to 9 short lines and additionally managed $3.7 million in federal funds appropriated to the Lakeview line and to the Astoria line. So it's been a busy biennium, and we are hopeful that as we move forward in the next biennium, we'll be able to continue making those kinds of contributions to the overall rail system.
Did that $2 million leverage what we were expecting as far as?
It leveraged, Chair George, it leveraged some funds for the Mount Hood Railroad, which did receive a loan from the federal government. I might add that the Mount Hood Railroad is the only short line railroad in the country to have received what's called a RIF loan. The only other railroad to be approved for a RIF loan was Amtrak. We suspect that the state's involvement or our paying for a portion of that helped to move that one along. None of the other railroads applied for the RIF loan in Oregon for a number of reasons that I think are good reasons, and there was no other federal funding that came available. Once again, there are a number of bills moving through Congress that would provide federal funding, but it didn't happen last time. It hasn't happened for a while. We are requesting a new position this time, rather much like transit. We really do need full-time financial management position within the rail division. We handle a lot of money. We have a lot of money coming in and a lot of money going out and multiple funding sources that must be tracked separately. So I am in desperate need of having someone within the office who is knowledgeable about our program and our multiple funding sources to help us out. I think we answered Thursday some questions about the limitation for the Lewis and Clark excursion train. We are seeking limitation, and I think we're still trying to get the numbers down depending on what the steering committee in Astoria determines is the how many days they want to operate this first year and what they want to do in the future. But we do not expect to seek any additional state funds for that. That's simply a limitation to handle the money that would be coming from external sources. And with that, I will close my presentation. If any of you have any questions, obviously I'm here to answer them.
Any questions? Senator Dukes?
The decision not to seek any state funding of Lewis and Clark excursion train was made locally, made within ODOT, made in the governor's office?
I believe it was made by the emergency board. We did seek money in
Senator Dukes. The legislature made that decision when they took all of the transportation operating money and transferred it to the general fund in this last special session as one action, but the emergency board also made that decision not to operate the train.
The emergency board doesn't get to make that decision.
When the agency came and requested limitation for operations, they decided that this wasn't a good time to be using that money when it could offset general fund in the budget for
Well, I understand
programs.
All of that. It's just that that is beyond their constitutional authority.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, they have the authority to deny requests.
Yes.
And that's what they did.
But we're now in a budget for the next fiscal year, so I
and
was just curious as to who had
Senator
made that
Dukes,
decision.
Senator Dukes, the legislature made that decision when they transferred the money to the general fund.
Well, I'm just remaining silent. I don't
The legislature can't make decisions for the entire... I mean, the e-board can't make decisions for the entire legislature, and the budget is before us.
Senator Morris.
I get the point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Claudia, could you look at page 67, which is the the question with respect to the bond proceeds, $15,515,000. How does that relate to the transit budget? I assume that's for the Wilsonville to Beaverton project. And that transit division, that cost was $123 million, as I believe. How does this $15.5 million relate to that budget within the transit division?
Chair George, Senator Morse, I don't believe there is any budget limitation in the transit division for commuter rail. I think what happened was the Washington County people made their presentation sort of as an overlap to the transit division, so that may be why there's a little bit of confusion. But the state's contribution to that project is within the rail division's budget. The rest of that funding is going to be coming from TriMet from the county, so it won't come through the state budget process at all.
So it's not within the transit budget?
That's correct.
No. Okay.
No.
Okay. Thank you. Another question?
Certainly.
Chair.
Senator Moore?
Looking at two questions with respect to rail planning projects and operations, the description for those involves a number of things. And I'm wondering the dramatic increase from 99 to 05, but more than doubling What's the cause for that increase?
Chair George, Senator Morse, a big portion of that is actually associated with the commuter rail. This also ends up being a roll-up of some of the federally funded priority projects that are really not within our management that are coming through our budget. It's about $18 million of that that is now available to those projects. It just comes from the federal funds. Those are the two big items. There's also included in that the general fund support for passenger rail. And I think probably within this number is the limitation for the Astoria project as well. I'd be very happy to provide that. In fact, I have it here, but I wanted to double check it because I just got it on Friday myself, is to actually know what adds up to the $50 million. We can easily get that for you.
Operations and administration, the 9901 was 136,000, and it was jumped in excess of a million. An explanation, please.
Chair George, Senator Morris, I was ready for that question. Part of this has to do with, in 99-2001, we were actually sort of transiting from being part of another division into our division, and so that number is kind of an odd number. We've been in motion, I guess, since we were moved from PUC, so some of the budget numbers don't track across the board. We get into 2001-03 and then up to 305. A portion of that relates to where the central services assessment is budgeted. That used to be a revenue transfer, and it's now a budget. It's an expenditure item. So it just simply ends up being in there. I think if we went back and backtracked, what you'd find is that the actual growth has been relatively flat. It's just where we're charging those various areas. Also, this assumes the addition of the financial management position that we mentioned earlier that will fall under that particular line item, and includes the two of the clerical positions I mentioned earlier that we did not, at least one of them, we didn't fill until about 3 weeks ago because we were unable to. But I've got the detail on that as well. In fact, I've got it here and would be happy to provide exactly what's in there because I actually had that question too. But in terms of real money, it's not really, it hasn't changed very much. It's just simply where that's getting plugged into from a budget standpoint. I don't cost that much. I do know that.
Any further questions? Claudia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to have Lorna come up, and Laura's going to do an interview.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Good morning, Chair George, members of the subcommittee. Susie's hand. Oh, for the record, I'm Lori Byerly, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management Division Analyst for the Department of Transportation. Susie should just hand you a packet which provides the governor's budget overview for the Driver and Motor Vehicle Services Division within the department. If you'll turn to page 2, you'll see this familiar worksheet that kind of shows over time what's happened to the Department of Motor Vehicle Services budget. This department is responsible primarily for driver and vehicle safety in the state of Oregon. The change in the division's budget from the 2103 close of session to the 2305 governor's budget is about a 6.8% increase. The change from where the budget stood as of the close of the fifth special session to the governor's budget is about a 1.2% increase. What you might want to note on here is that the division did start off with some general fund at the beginning of the 2001-03 biennium. This was for the motor voter program. The agency was able to shift those general fund expenditures to other funds from the transportation operating fund, and so you'll see that general fund component is gone in 2003-05. The division's budget remains pretty much flat as part of overall allocations of revenue from highway funds and other sources. The Department of Transportation has kind of maintained this division's funding at a pretty much flat level for 03-05. You'll take a look at page 3.
Mr. Chair, before you use that page, can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. So motor voter is now being paid for with highway funds?
Senator Dukes, Chair George, it's being paid for with transportation operating fund, the lawnmower money. That's probably the better vernacular for that, lawnmower money. So it's money that comes in as part of highway fund, but it's determined it's not really highway fund related, carved off to the side and been used to backfill quite a substantial portion of general fund in the department's budget.
I'll never start claiming that money. This state's in a world of hurt, I got to tell you.
On page...
Yeah.
On page 2, if you look at the bullet points on there, like I said, it's pretty much a flat budget showing a 1.2% increase. It is all other funded. The general fund is gone from the budget. The budget did use other funds to offset general fund reductions. The budget continues core services while making reductions and promotes a leaner and more efficient operation organization. Page 4, like I said previously, the department division's budget is all other funds at this point. The bulk of that comes from highway fund and fee revenue. If you look at how they expend their budget of $126.8 million other funds, you'll see that personal services is about 67%. Debt service is for some outstanding debt service on COPs from a DMV building construction back in 97. Small portion for capital outlay, small portion for special payments. This division operates primarily through direct customer service, supporting field offices and operations across the state. So the bulk of its expenditures are in the personal services arena. If you look on page 5, to kind of back up a little bit, we can see where we started to develop the 2003-05 budget. We started with the 2001-03 legislatively adopted budget at $118.7 million total funds. Included some actions that had occurred through April 2002. Like with the previous divisions, this falls in line with governor's budget development timelines, realizing we have to pick a point in time at which to start adding numbers in that we can't, unfortunately, incorporate all those actions up through Special Session 6 that we discussed last week. Part of these actions included funding related to a September 2001 emergency board action, which had added 3 positions to implement older driver study recommendations. This study addressed issues about at-risk drivers and provided the division with limitation and position support to work on a result of that study and recommendations. The November 2001 emergency board added 5 positions for information technology needs at about $2 million. About half of this amount is for ongoing costs. Part of that was for one-time investments, which was phased out in the package 020 program adjustments for this division. This emergency board action relates directly to conversations that occurred during the 2001 regular session when the department came forward or division came forward with information technology initiatives. It was kind of a follow-up to actions that took place there. The division was directed to come back and provide more information to be able to secure the limitation and positions needed to carry out those projects. Budget also includes some base budget adjustments related to position actions and compensation changes. We'll take a look at page 6, moving on to essential packages that were implemented to develop the 2003-05 governor's budget. Package 010 included some personal services type adjustments. These are adjustments that aren't driven directly off employee compensation costs. They relate to things like temporary payments, overtime, and mass transit taxes, about $20,000 there. Package 020 added some program adjustments. These were some phase-ins for fleet acquisition, drug testing transfer from Motor Carrier Transportation Division, and law enforcement data system agreement costs, about $300,000 for those. Then the package turned around and also eliminated those one-time costs I mentioned earlier for information technology projects, as well as some costs for special license plate startup, the older driver program startup, and it also shifted administrative rules coordinator function from Driver Motor Vehicle Services to Central Services. This is a more centralized function for the department, and they wanted to shift the position over to that more centralized function. Package 030 includes inflation and price list adjustments of about $3 million for this division. On page 7, policy packages in the division's budget include package 070, which addresses the reductions I spoke about earlier, about $6.5 million in revenue shortfalls, eliminates 24 positions based on agency revenue projections and allocations. This allows the division to sustain its core activities, but does and will impact service quality and customer wait times. The package also included about $5,000 in limitation related to fees. The division had raised some fees through administrative rule over the course of the 2001-03 biennium. The way we implemented these fees that needed to be ratified in the budget was to take them out of the base and restore them in a policy package. And all those fees will be addressed as part of the agency's fee bill that we'll work on towards the end of the public hearing process. But that was the mechanism we used to identify fees that needed to be ratified. We tried to pull them out of the budget and then restore them so we could clearly see what the impact of those fee increases are on expenditure limitation and any other types of actions the agency's taking. Package 081 relates to actions from the 2002 third special session. This eliminated cost of living increases for one position above salary range 38 at a reduction of $7,629. Mm-hmm. On page 8, policy packages continued. Package 082 relates to actions from the 2002 fifth special session. This is a net zero package. It makes the shift in motor voter from general fund to other funds at a shift of $188,000. Package 200 relates to the older driver study. It adds one permanent program technician, one position, to work on assessments and education as part of the recommendations under this study. The package is self-funding because it makes reductions in other expenditures to offset the position cost of about $95,000. Package 495 relates to those fees that I had said were phased out or reduced earlier. Brings in the revenue and fees related to financial responsibility fee that the department implemented during 2001-03 and a recreational vehicle show license fee that the division also increased by administrative rule. That pretty much sums up the changes for the Driver Motor Vehicle Services Division. If you have any questions, I'm ready.
We better ask that question.
I didn't know we had a recreational vehicle show license fee.
That's a mouthful of Monday.
If you're ready for me?
We're going to answer the question.
Mr. Chair, I am Lorna Youngs, Administrator of the Motor Vehicle Division. In the last session, there was a bill passed to create a fee for large RV shows. The concern was that there'd be a lot of out-of-state companies coming in, showing a lot of vehicles, potentially competing with their recreational vehicle manufacturers here in Oregon. So they asked to have a show fee put in place so that the department would then regulate the shows to make sure that the sales were being conducted according to Oregon law and that titles were being appropriately transferred, et cetera. It's a small fee, but that we implemented it during this biennium.
Prediction isn't to me, but yeah. Whatever.
I'll have to go back and check, see how we voted on that one.
Right? It's probably part of a package.
No, let me begin then with a presentation of the DMV budget, and it starts on page 71 of the program overview. The DMV is probably one of the few agencies that touches most Oregonians, and we think of ourselves essentially as the face of Oregon government, and certainly we are the face of Oregon government for anyone first coming into the state, because that's one of the first things you do is get your license, driver license changed, or your vehicle title and register here in Oregon. And so we certainly take that responsibility seriously to provide efficient and effective customer service. We have a threefold mission. to promote driver safety, to protect financial and ownership interest in vehicles, and to collect revenue for Oregon's roads. We deliver our services through two major program areas, our driver programs, which is essentially all about driver licensing and managing the driver record, and vehicle programs, in which we are registering and titling vehicles as well as regulating businesses that sell vehicles. If you look on page 73, our service delivery goals are to provide fast, efficient, and high-quality service and several options for doing business with DMV, as well as confidential treatment of your personal information. We have 64 field offices. We provide transactions through the mail. We have two telephone call centers, one located in Salem and one located at the Women's Correctional Facility at Coffee Creek, which answers the phones for most of the state. We're working on looking at the possibility of expanding that to the eastern part of Oregon. We provide services through the Internet, and hopefully by the end of this summer we will have transactions over the Internet. And we also provide services through private and public partnerships. The major driver programs that we provide, of course, are driver licensing. We test your ability, both knowledge and your driving skills. We provide information about what the rules of the road are through the driver manuals and other publications. And then once you have your driver license, we then monitor your driving, essentially through our responsibility to record on your driving record any transactions that have occurred with the courts. In other words, any tickets or convictions that you've got are then transferred to the department, and we record those on your driver license record. And those records are then available to various sources that are required by statute to check, like employers, for example, are checking driver records all the time. We promote driver safety by ensuring that the tests meet or exceed national standards, and that we are monitoring your driver record. And we also have an additional administrative authority through our driver improvement program, which allows us, if you have four or more tickets, moving violations, or accidents within a two-year period, to take suspension action against your license. We have if you get three, we do send you a warning in the form of a restriction on your record. So that is our program to essentially reduce the likelihood of you ultimately ending up in some serious accidents by taking some progressive discipline against individuals whose driving behavior shows that they need to slow down or stop at intersections appropriately. We also have the graduated driver license, which was passed two sessions ago, which you probably heard in Troy's presentation earlier on driver safety, or transportation safety has been very successful in reducing the incidence of crashes and deaths among teenagers. And we are just about to launch or implement the recommendations of the older driver, or medically at-risk driver program, which will allow us to do a better job of monitoring drivers who, for one reason or another, are no longer physically or mentally capable of driving safely. We're also responsible for distributing disabled placards, which are of course based on the certification of the physician.
Senator Carter.
Just a couple questions. Is there protection of the law in terms of disabled parking on say a bank, and somebody park there on a Sunday? Can a person get a ticket if the place, if the establishment itself is not open?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, my understanding is that no one is to park in a disabled parking spot without a disabled placard at any time. But I can verify that and get that information to you.
I had an irate person to call me and say it was on a Sunday, and they were parking, talking to some people, had a little small stand on the bank's parking lot, and they got a ticket for disabled parking. And I was just wondering if the establishment itself is closed, does that still apply?
Mr. Chair, Senator Conard, the fact that the police ticketed him makes me believe it may very well, but I will verify that.
Not the police.
Oh, it was not the police.
It was one of the...
There are some volunteer patrols mm-hmm. for disabled parking, but let me verify that information and get that to you.
See, the other thing, I think that's a misnomer, too. Even if the police gave a ticket, is it a legal entity if the place is closed? I mean, just because they're the police, they don't go around hogging, you know, rights. So is it legally binding on a day that the establishment itself is closed?
I will get that information for you.
Thank you.
Moving on to the vehicle programs, then. Primarily, for vehicle programs, we register vehicles to make sure that they are easily identified. That's the purpose of the license plate, as well as to raise revenue for Oregon highways. There are about 4 million registered vehicles in Oregon, and we register for 2 years, so we conduct about 2 million registration transactions a year. We also make sure that vehicles in the Portland and Medford area meet the DEQ air quality emission standards before they are registered, and we have an excellent partnership with the DEQ in that you can also register your vehicle at the DEQ at the time that you go through the emission stations. And I believe that DEQ is registering at this time about 23% of our registration renewals are processed through DEQ. So it's a very successful partnership and very convenient for the customer. We also provide temporary trip permits to allow people that do not have registered vehicles currently registered to move them on the roadway to get them someplace for repair or if they're waiting for their title from out of state. We have a temporary registration process. We also issue, as you know, more than one kind of plate, plates that raise fees with various funds. Probably the most successful recent plate that raises fees is the Crater Lake plate, which has been a very successful seller. DMV issues titles that provide ownership. Excuse me.
How many special fundraising license plates do we have in Oregon now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, we have lots.
We get carried away with it.
In fact, there has been some interest in addressing that issue. We have two types, essentially. We have what we call the general issue special plate, which is available to everyone, the salmon plate, the tree plate, the cultural trust fund plate, and the Crater Lake plate, or the sort of the general issue plate. And then we have what we call the group plate, which is a tree plate with a little insignia on the side. And we have a lot of those.
I understand you guys are getting gray hair over there.
Well, there many of them are just sitting there gathering dust, and it does take a bit of effort to get them organized. So we've got probably at least 30 of the group plates, and of course the four major plates, and then of course we have a number of different types of plates depending upon the kind of vehicle. So you've got plates for motorcycles and plates for motorhomes. And so there's probably 70-plus different types of plates by the time you get all of those configured together.
My concern has always been that the purpose of the license plate is to identify that it's an Oregon plate and to figure out what the letters and numbers are so that you could get a hit-and-run driver or a kidnapper or whatever.
Absolutely.
And the latest plate to come out doesn't look anything like any of the other plates. It's pink. I probably shouldn't say anything on the record about it more than that. But I think that we're going further and further afield if our goal is to be able to identify that it's an Oregon plate and get what the letters and numbers are. So I get concerned. Someday some kid's going to get kidnapped and we're going to miss him because, you know, We thought it was an out-of-state license plate when it wasn't.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, we share your concerns that it does make a lot of confusing for law enforcement with so many different kinds of configurations for Oregon plates.
Are there that have been introduced in this session of the legislature?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I believe that there is some work being done to reduce that. I don't know where it sits, but I think there is more interest in moving either to a group plate or some other alternative, because as it turns out, they have not been the money makers that people have hoped for, except for perhaps the Crater Lake plate, because the graphic is very attractive.
Yes.
And it is a one-time fee.
Lorna, a question on the issue of after last session's adjustments, we are recovering all of our cost for those plates. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, we are. In fact, that is taken out of the cost of the plate as they come in, and we also build up a small fund for the repurchase of plates, so we're not using the highway fund to even purchase plates. So they're covered.
Attorney Morrison, do you have a question?
That's fine.
Okay.
DMV issues titles for the purpose of proving ownership and to protect financial interest in vehicles, as well as security interest holders. We issue about 1.2 million titles per year, and last session, Oregon Transportation Investment Act raised the fees, so now the title fee as well as the registration fee are revenue-generating fees for the Oregon highways.
Thank you. I've had a minor situation, but it seemed a little more complicated. I had to transfer title of a vehicle that had been registered in my wife's name before she passed away, and it was kind of one of the things that intrigued me from the standpoint of going through the process. I had to get a form notarized that I was the sole heir to this vehicle, which didn't seem outrageous, but it meant that I had to go leave the motor vehicle office, go 10 or 12 blocks away, and go to my credit union and get that form notarized. The irony is, when you get the form notarized, the person doing the looks at your driver's license to see whether or not you're really who you are, and it seemed to me that that's probably the motor vehicle office was better equipped to compare my driver's license and signature and stuff than a notary. I'm kind of wondering if simplifying that process might be good public service, and how often I know there's a lot of complications on anything that involves legal ownership and owning I didn't introduce legislation because I thought that would I didn't want three hearings before judiciary committees to try. But it just seemed like it was an awkward extra step in a relatively routine transaction. And especially this concept that with you having all of the license, the driver's license, picture information there on file and on computer access to it, that would be a truer test of proving someone's identity than showing your driver's license to another.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I will take a look in why that particular instance we require a notarized signature. The problem is solved in most cases by having right of survivorship right on the title, and if the cases where there isn't, then we need to have some official documentation, and I can certainly provide you with the statutes that would require the notarization. Let me follow up on that.
Or I was surprised that there wasn't someone with notary authority at the motor vehicle office.
We can certainly look into that as well. Mr. Chair, Representative.
Other questions? Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. a general question.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm an illegal alien, can I get a driver's license, title of vehicle, and register to vote?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, legal presence in the United States is not a prerequisite of licensing here in Oregon or registration of vehicles. We do need to know that you are who you are, and you do need to provide us with enough proof that you have been a resident of Oregon, but we do not inquire into your immigration status. That is not one of the requirements under Oregon statute. Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, I am not quite sure about the voter laws. Thank you, Senator Dukes.
It is a very interesting subject, though.
Yeah, that's not for this.
Yeah. Right.
That is an interesting subject.
A question relative to the title fees, and since we're all giving our personal examples, my wife titled a trailer the other day, and the title fees now were over 20% of the cost of what I paid for that trailer. And so how much additional money are we yielding from those increases last time above our cost of operation that go into the...
Mr. Chair, Senator George, we had established our cost of operation at approximately $17 per transaction on average. The title fee is at $30 for a light vehicle and $90 for heavy vehicle.
$90 when they got me. Now, how many extra dollars is that yielding?
I do not have that number before me, but
I certainly we'll get it for you.
Okay.
All right, thank you. Times the transaction volume, and I don't have the transaction volume here.
Seems like you had that number. Okay.
The question is, how ratty of a trailer can you get?
Well, this
is only four times across the registration.
You're talking to me that quietly.
You're talking to a farmer here. Listen, we'll take it whenever we get it. This is a 40-foot over-the-road trailer. It's pretty nice. It's road legal.
Thank you. And finally, this under our vehicle programs, we have the DMV business regulation section, which licenses and monitors the activities of vehicle dealers for two reasons: to make sure that titles are appropriately transferred and that the secured loans are paid off at the time of sale. Issues related to the quality of the car and misrepresentation of that are all handled by the Department of Justice, not by DMV. And under this program, we have civil penalty authority as well as the ability to suspend licenses for failure to, for consistent poor behavior. We measure our performance in several ways, and we have put within our presentation a graphical a representation of the performance measures that you've seen that gives you get kind of a sense of the movement in time. On page 75, we have what is performance measure number 21 under the goal of customer satisfaction for ODOT, which is our performance measure of customer satisfaction ratings. Every month we poll 400 individuals who've been to the DMV field office for the previous month, and we're looking for essentially two sets of questions. Their satisfaction with our courtesy, knowledge, efficiency, and helpfulness, as well as their satisfaction with the wait time. And we separate the two because we recognize 100% or an 80% satisfaction with wait time would require quite a heavy staffing level. At any rate, we are still able to stay within our expected wait times, which you see on the next page, where our goal is around 15, and then we have managed to hold that average. So you see the seasonal variations that occur during the summer months. The next three goals, which are essentially service delivery goals, which are on page 77, are part of the performance measure number 22 for ODOT. We're also measuring our transactions per hour, our productivity, on the top of page 76. That's our way of making sure that we're essentially keeping ahead of the volume of transactions, even with reducing FTE. And then our safe driver performance measure is a new measure that we established this year to begin to get a handle on what do we want to try and ultimately measure as an outcome. We measure outcomes in transportation safety in terms of accidents and deaths. But with DMV, we're kind of further back up the line. What we're really looking at is if you have drivers whose records are free of accidents or moving violations, in other words, what we call safe drivers, our goal would be to increase the number of drivers in that category under the theory that if you are not committing driving errors, you're less likely to get into an accident or end up a fatality on Oregon's roadways. So at this point, there are about 62 or approximately 63% of the Oregon driving population that has a three-year history that is essentially free from any traffic violations or accidents. And we're hoping through our driver improvement programs, through the continued efforts with teen driver, and certainly with the medical at-risk driver program, to be able to work with this population before they get any traffic violations. And we hope to move that up to 64% by the year 2005, because we know, given the size of the population, a significant or even a 1 or 2% swing represents quite a new large number of individuals. Page 78 is just a continuation of our service delivery levels, where we've got at least 11 or so internal service delivery levels that we monitor to make sure that we're continuing to deliver what people are expecting, which is fast, efficient service. So what is it that you're going to get for the $126 million that we are asking for next biennium? If you'll turn to page 82, I want to talk to you a little bit about the major initiatives that we plan for next biennium. Of course, we will continue to be delivering the driver licensing and vehicle services with as close as we can to our service delivery goals. But in addition, we have three major initiatives that we want to continue. Driver safety, of course, base mission. And the major effort under the Driver Safety Initiative is to implement the expanded reporting requirements that were passed in the last session. We spent most of the interim working very closely and diligently with the medical community and are just about ready to launch in a phased-in approach the expanded medical reporting program. And tied to that is Package 200, self-funded program technician position, which was given to us last session as one of the three limited duration positions we received to implement this bill. We see this position as still critical for the coordination of the training and outreach that we need to work on with physicians in order to be successful with this program. Essentially, what the new expanded medical reporting program will require is that physicians will need to report to us individuals who have either cognitive or functional impairments across a broad spectrum, but of the nature that affect driving ability, but only when those conditions are severe and uncontrollable or uncorrectable by any medication, any driving device, etc. So when you first get diagnosed with Alzheimer's, you're not reported. It's only at the point when the Alzheimer's has progressed that you are not capable of remembering where you are, how to function in a vehicle. You get lost. You get confused. You are a danger to yourself on the road. It certainly would be a danger to other drivers. And similar with any other progressive sort of disease. Blind is, of course, pretty straightforward, but with many other conditions, it's only when you get to the end stage where all medication fails, all surgery, all corrective devices fails to allow you to drive safely, and it's only at that point that the physicians are mandatorily required to report to you. And as you can imagine, a program like this needs quite a bit of outreach and education and training, and this position that we're asking for is integral to that program.
Mona, before you go ahead, is there any potential liability for a physician, since we require them to do this, that they should fail to? Was that discussed?
Mr. Chair, the law gives the physicians immunity for reporting, but the physicians are also concerned about potential liability for failing to report.
Failing to, right.
There is a voluntary reporting component of this, which has always been in place, and the physician could certainly avail themselves of that. But we are, in fact, there has been a bill introduced to turn the entire program into a voluntary reporting program, and that was heard last week, and we are working with the Oregon Medical Association to see what we can do to allay their concerns there and still maintain the mandatory reporting nature of it, because we haven't even had a chance to implement this to see how effective it is. But, yes, that is a concern. In addition to the at-risk driver program, we also are working on developing a community-based partnership. We're in the beginning stages of that, which was one of the additional recommendations from the older driver study, which helps support individuals' self-assessment tools. We want to give them information about public transit availabilities, ways in which family support, so that if individuals are beginning to get their driver license restricted or ultimately lose their license, there are ways in which we can provide information and support to them so that they do not feel as isolated and unable to move forward. And that's going to require a broad coalition, and we're just getting started in trying to pull together that community-based approach. We also want to research the demographics of problem drivers to make sure that we're doing a better job of aiming our driver improvement program at problem drivers. And then, of course, we'll need to implement any changes needed in the licensing of commercial drivers that are required by the federal government. Our second initiative is on fraud prevention, both the driver license fraud to prevent identity theft, as well as taking a good look at our titling processes and our branding process to make sure that we are reducing fraud related to vehicle ownership or condition. We have been working now for over a year with an ad hoc coalition task force on identity theft to look at ways that we can improve our programs. We are about ready to install this fall a new digital photo license, which will have far more security features than our current license has. We were given authority to broaden our title brands. A brand essentially is when there's damage to a vehicle, like it's been in a flood or it has had severe damage or it's a Lemon Law buyback. That brand carries with the title and gives the owner not only information about what the car is, but what may have happened to the car in the past. And we want to make sure that we have our brands more in sync with what's in the other kinds of brands in the other parts of the country.
Senator Dukes?
Are we starting to get stuff branded that maybe we never intended to? One of my kids totaled a car I had within the last year. And it was totaled mostly because of a piece of electronics and two airbags that went. The frame was fine. The only thing under the hood that was damaged was the windshield washer container. I mean, clearly the hood, and there was some other stuff. But in terms of the structure of the vehicle, it was fine. I assume they scrapped it. I went through it was a good car. I went through gymnastics to try to see if there was any way to save this car, and financially it wasn't worth the investment. But had I done it, it would have been branded.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, yes. Once the insurance company declares this car totaled, then it will become branded. If you work on it, it will be branded as reconstructed.
But they total it for a financial reason. And now with all of the interesting things we've put in, all the electronics and stuff, it's possible that the car could be fine and structural. Well, not, I mean, it still needs work, but I was just curious if we're, because originally we branded vehicles because something had happened to them. I mean, if it's been sitting in salt water or if it's, you know, something like that, then you can expect repercussions from it. If the frame is you know, damaged badly, you can expect repercussions from it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, that it's standard across the United States for vehicles to be branded as having been totaled, regardless of whether or not there's structural damage to it. Once the insurance company declares it, so the car does carry that brand, even though it may be structurally sound and with some additional resources put into it, brought back into full operating. But that's pretty much standard procedure across the United States.
It seems to me that we're losing where we started with that. Now, maybe it's still fine. I mean, you know, it was in an accident, that we started, so that getting the brand doesn't necessarily tell you what it used to tell you.
Senator Boris.
Mr. Chairman, in looking at your DMV from home and the use of information technology,
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, I'm not completely familiar with what Arizona has done. Many states have essentially hired a third party like IBM to set up their internet and run the transactions, etc. The state of Oregon made the decision several years ago that that the state would run the portal through which the money transactions would go. So we outsource the building of the program, but since the state portal is the source through which the financial piece runs through, we can't outsource the whole thing until the state decides to outsource all of it.
Components for them. Probably transaction costs for the agency.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, we are in the process of implementing an internet registration renewal. And we've dealt with security contract, and we're beginning to work on that. So we will have an opportunity to see how that reduces our transaction costs for registration renewals. All registration renewals can be handled by mail, a significant portion or not. So we're hopeful that it will reduce the most expensive route, which is to do it through the field office.
Well, I know this is way before you took over management, but we all remember the DMV computer fiasco. How? And then the thing that bothered me in the hearings we sat through on that whole issue was the fact that when we were all said and done, I asked the question, what did we buy? And, well, we didn't buy anything. And I know from that point on, we were starting basically from ground zero. Can you kind of give us a report of what your view is of our computing ability and how we've recovered from that?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I don't think the answer that we didn't buy anything at all is entirely true. There were a number of upgrades that were made. There were essentially six different systems that were built that were essentially going to be all tied together. And the grand scheme of the full build-out, I think, of this program was that you would essentially be able to do any transaction anywhere at any time. And it was a ambitious undertaking, and it's failed in almost every state in which it was tried.
That was the report we got also.
That anytime you get a upgrade that's going to take you 6 or 8 years to get done, you should run like heck from it. So we did get our network tied together. We got a good cash handling system. I think we still don't have about a 30-year-old legacy system, and I think of it as simply remodeling it room by room as opposed to taking the approach of a whole-scale remodel. And so every biennium, our computer plan has a combination of expanded services for the public like Internet, as well as base improvements to the computer system that we have so that we can upgrade the language. And today what you find is that with the advent of what they call middleware, you are able to get an internet front end, have some middle software, and you hook it up to your mainframe without actually having to revamp the mainframe. And that is really the route we are exploring now. So we'll continue to need to upgrade the existing computer, but it is functional, and mainframes are the best, most efficient way to handle the massive transactions that we have.
Good. Thank you.
So as you can see, let me quickly, you can see that there's additional fraud prevention activities on the driver's side that we're looking at. Senator Morrison jumped right to our DMV from home, which is providing alternatives to go to the field office, which is the most expensive way to deliver transactions in person, as you know. So we're looking at registration renewal, address change, and other expansions to Internet in the next biennium, such as ordering custom plates, individual driver records. We want to improve site navigation, put more interactive information, and then also increase the opportunity for businesses to send us information online. Right now, we're in the pilot of electronic vehicle registration, in which auto dealers can hand out plates and stickers at the time of sale and enter the title information directly into DMV computer. We want to look at more expansion of that kind of information.
Hold on, that have the pilots worked okay on that? Because I know there were a few that were being set up a couple of years ago to enter into the process and be entrusted with some of those responsibilities?
Mr. Chair, currently we are in about the third or fourth month of the pilot on electronic vehicle registration, and so far it seems to be going fairly well. We've only got about 9 or 10 dealers involved so that we can make sure we have good data to make sure that the data integrity and security. And once we passed about a 3 or 4 month period of evaluation, then we will secure a contractor to expand that statewide and look at other opportunities. So that pretty much concludes my presentation in terms of our mission, how we get it accomplished, how we measure it, and what you can expect for the money that we're asking for next biennium. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
On the back, I was looking on the customer service graphs, page 77.
Mm-hmm.
And we all remember it about 1999, right after session, we began to pick up, you know, positive responses. And can you kind of tell me what happened and what do we need to do to make sure that we keep those, you know, response times, average seconds, keep them low? I know you're going to say, well, it's more personnel right now that are being eliminated. But something happened right there, and I think it was a societal shift partly within the agency, an attitude that was changed. And can you kind of give us a little bit of background as to what your view is or vision for where we're headed?
Mr. Chair, our goal is to try and hold to the 15-minute average wait time. Now, you recognize with the 15-minute average, it's 15 minutes average across the state, across the year. And the actual variation occurs, the peaks occur in the summer. But with a average 15-minute wait time, that means about 70 to 75% of the customers are experiencing a 15 minutes or less wait time. We've actually got enough data that we've done some pretty thorough analyses to see how many people are waiting more than 15 minutes. So our goal is to continue to stay as closely as we can to that. One of the ways in which we have been accomplishing that in the past is when people are ill, we keep our field offices essentially in a cluster formation, and we send people from the main office in an area, let's say Central Oregon. Bend would be the main office. If they're down in Madras by just a one person, somebody from Bend would come out. So one of the ways in which we manage that, of course, is to move people to cover. We also advertise in the theaters, don't come on Monday, don't come on Friday afternoon. With more information on the internet, what we're hoping is we get more people coming using alternative means. But we're still dealing with the fact that when we survey individuals and ask why do they come to a field office, is it because everything is too late or what? Many of them want to have that face-to-face transaction. So unlike motor carrier, which is able to use the internet very extensively because they are business-to-government entity, our customers have sometimes complex transactions. They don't see us very often. They don't understand the rules very well sometimes and want that face-to-face. But we're looking at ways in which we can reduce the transaction volume in the field offices and look at more efficient means of delivering service.
See, that's what happens. If you treat people really nicely, then they want to come down and see you. So.
Well, that's an unexpected benefit.
Senator Morris.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Page 83, the source of missing funds.
Yes.
The transfers out,
mm-hmm.
What do those add or subtract to DMV?
Well, essentially, as Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, we collect fees not only to cover DMV costs, but we collect fees for the highway. So the transfer out to the highway division is for highway construction. The transportation safety transfer is a We are collecting in the course of the driver license a 25-cent fee for driver improvement, and so we transfer that over to transportation safety. We also collect motorcycle, additional fee for motorcycles endorsements, and so that's what that transfer is. Of course, our central services, the funds that come in, that pays for our central services allotment. And then we have transfers to the cities and counties as well for their portion of the highway funds. And then our other agency transfers are the transfers of the funds that we're collecting for stickers, for state parks, on recreational vehicles, the salmon funds fees, all of the fees that come in with plates are the funds that we collect and then transfer to other agencies.
So this could be called a cash cow.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, all DMVs are for the most part set up to be cash cows. They are the if they are collecting vehicle fees, then they are collecting for their state the registration or title fees or any kind of fees that are has been established to pay for transportation funding.
Central services, is that does that function have anything to do with the actual DMV function?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, central services is essentially the centralized information technology, business and personnel, and fleet management. In other words, all of the centralized services for the Department of Transportation, which are then charged back to each of the divisions in proportion to their use. About three-quarters of our central service charges are for information technology, the cost of running the mainframe computer, as well as the cost of all of our help desk support. If you can imagine, we have 64 field offices. We need to make sure that our computer systems are up and running 24/7 for batch work overnight. So a large proportion of our central service charges are related to managing the computer system.
Senator Carter.
Under what circumstances do you transfer dollars out to other agencies' purposes?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, those are transfers to state parks for the recreational vehicle fees that go to state parks. We transfer salmon plate money to OWEB. So wherever we're collecting a plate or registration sticker that has been a specific surcharge set by the legislature to go to fund an activity in another agency, that's what that is for.
Certainly follow up.
Do other agencies pay you so much, pay the Department of Transportation so much?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, the cost of conducting the transaction is subtracted from it, so they pay their overhead because we can't use highway fund to
right.
to
con- that's
collect.
That's what I'm concerned about. Are you getting yours back?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Any other questions?
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to present before you today.
And we have some time, so let's get started with motor carrier. And, Lori, you imagine you're going to walk us through another one.
George, members of the subcommittee, you should have in front of you a packet from Motor Carrier Transportation Division. And you'll take a look at page 2. You'll see a budget comparison of the division's budget history in the brief past. To start off with, this division within the Department of Transportation helps truckers comply with Oregon laws and regulations, promotes a safe and efficient, responsible commercial transportation industry, weighs and checks trucks across the state for size and weight and safety issues, basically tries to oversee and manage the statewide trucking commercial operations in the state to ensure the benefit to the industry as well as to the state. If you'll take a look at the change from columns over there on the far right-hand side, you'll see that like driver motor vehicle services, the budget for motor carrier transportation is pretty much flat. If you look at the change from where the budget is as of the 2001-03 fifth special sessions and with the 2003-05 governor's budget, it's about a 3.2% increase. If you look at the column that says the change from 2001-03 close of session, you'll see a rather larger increase there. This is primarily due to the shift of the motor carrier transportation audit functions. They were previously in central services, but they've now been moved to the motor carrier transportation division. So there's about 50 positions that moved. So that's that big shift there. Revenue for this division, as you can see, there is no general fund revenue. It's all other fund. It comes from weight mile taxes paid by truckers, truck registration fees, as well as some dollars from the federal government for motor carrier safety grants and safety operations. If you take a look on page 3, like I said, the governor's budget is a 3.2% increase from the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget through the fifth special session. The budget continues core services while decreasing some staff and reducing some hours of operations in the field offices. It looks to new ways of doing business to help mitigate the impact of reductions on services. As Lorna mentioned earlier, the division has been very successful in conducting business and providing information over the Internet. And it looks to a lot of those e-government types of initiatives to help reduce the impact of some of these reductions. It also is looking at things like privatization of some functions to try and help save on costs and continue to provide good customer service. If you look on page 4, this shows the way the division spends its money in terms of budget category. You'll see personal services is the bulk of this division's cost. At 324 positions, most of these are positions directly serving the trucking industry, both in field offices around the state and in the Salem Central office. About 50 positions, as I mentioned earlier, do relate to motor carrier transportation audit. And there's about 40 positions that relate to safety investigations and work with the federal funding grant sources and programs for the department. Moving on to page 5. At 2003 close of session, the division had $41.8 million total funds. This is all other funds, or primarily other funds with a small portion of federal. We took that figure and we added in some actions that had occurred over the 2003 biennium. The April 2002 Emergency Board approved the transfer of 57 positions and $7 million other funds into the division from Central Services. This change placed the truck tax audit program structurally nearer to the motor carrier activities that it works with. So instead of being in Central Services, that function is now more closely aligned with the work it's overseeing. The audit function verifies accuracy of weight mile tax reports and payments and screens accounts to determine which accounts need to be looked at in more detail. So they do a lot of work with those accounts and payments coming to the system. We also included some base budget adjustments, rolled up some impacts of 2003 position actions and compensation changes. On page 6, standard essential packages for the division will look a lot like what we've seen in other divisions. Package 010 includes some adjustments for temporaries, overtime, and differentials, about $15,000 there. Package 020 includes a phase out or reduction related to fleet acquisition budget for this division, and also a phase out of the motor carrier drug testing program to driver motor vehicle services. This program is administered by driver motor vehicle services, but was located in motor carrier because of the funding available to sort the program came from a federal source and was directly related to the federal program, safety program. This is a program that is now, due to fund shifting, supported by Transportation Operating Fund, and so the program was moved back over to driver motor vehicles where it actually is carried out. So that's the change there.
Well, the federal funds aren't coming any longer?
Senator George, I believe the federal funds are still available, that the division can make those available for their uses, and Greg could clarify that.
That's correct.
Package 030, inflation and priceless adjustments. This includes inflation and state government service charges of just under $700,000, standard inflation about 3.5%, as well as some of those central charges or charges for the Department of Administrative Services and some other state agencies. Page 7, policy packages for the division. include a package that addresses revenue shortfalls. The department overall looked at revenue and allocations for 2003-05 and made some adjustments based on agency-wide priorities. It made a decision to keep motor carrier essentially flat by eliminated 13 positions. These are registration analyst positions. They are positions that do impact customer service and will likely require the closure of a couple of field offices. Like I said earlier, the division is looking to things like e-government and some other ways of trying to maintain its good customer service and carry its programs out at a higher level as possible. The package also removes $1.8 million in expenditures related to fees. The department began implementing an administration fee for the International Fuel Tax Agreement. This is an agreement that allows Oregon to collect, report, and pay fuel taxes to other jurisdictions. Several states participate in this agreement. As a result of Attorney General opinion, it was determined that Highway Fund could not cover administrative costs of this program, so the division implemented a fee to cover those costs. Senate Bill 740 from the 2001 session gave the division the authority to go ahead and establish that fee by administrative rule, which they've done. This fee revenue does need to be ratified and approved by the subcommittee, and so we've taken that out of the 070 package, and then we've plugged it back in another policy package to allow the committee to look at that decision more discreetly in terms of the budget. Package 081 is related to the 2002 third special session. It rolls forward the elimination of cost of living increases for a position at or above salary range 38. And then package 495, Senate Bill 333, fee ratification, $1.8 million. It restores those fees I talked about for the International Fuel Tax Agreement that the department implemented during the 2003 biennium. And that's the governor's budget.
Very good. Welcome, Greg. And I will bring that 40-foot trailer in if you want, since I've received some grief from my committee members for a safety inspection.
Did you make it this far?
Oh, yes.
Well, we'd be happy to accommodate you if you chose to do that. Good morning. I am Greg Delpani. I'm the administrator for the Motor Carrier Division for ODOT. I'm very happy to be here this morning, and I'm actually kind of excited to share with you about the activities of the men and women of the Motor Carrier Transportation Division. You've heard a little bit about our division. In essence, we exist to promote a safe, efficient, and a responsible commercial trucking industry in Oregon. On a day-to-day basis, that means we regulate the motor carrier industry. And the motor carrier industry is a very diverse industry. It ranges anywhere from the owner-operator operating a single truck to large corporate fleets that operate thousands of vehicles. Almost 25,000 registered motor carriers conduct business in Oregon, and collectively they represent well over 300,000 licensed trucks. We have four basic program areas, and I'll direct your attention to page 90 in your presentation materials. That's where our presentation commences. Our four basic program areas are the safety, investigations, and federal programs area, which are principally responsible for safety regulation and some of our intelligent transportation system technologies. Field carrier services, which is all about size and weight enforcement for trucks. Salem Motor Carrier Services section, which is responsible for registration and permitting activities. And the Motor Carrier Audit section, which is responsible for audit of highway use tax or weight mile tax, registration fees, and also through a Bay State agreement for fuel tax payments due and payable to other jurisdictions by interstate motor carriers based in Oregon. So I'd like to discuss these programs in a little bit more depth with you, beginning with Salem Motor Carrier Services. Well, with regard to registration, probably the foremost responsibility of this particular work group, and far and away the most visible, is the issuance of the license plates that are issued to motor carriers in this state. You're probably familiar with them. They're red and white. I had intended to bring one to show you, but I didn't anticipate we would be here this morning. You're moving expeditiously, so I came down from the third floor hearing room and didn't have my license plates with me. But I'm sure you've seen them. We issue about 50,000 such plates per year. We renew all of them. We issue more than 90,000 temporary passes and trip permits. These are temporary credentials in lieu of permanent credentials on a yearly basis. We collect about $12 million in registration fees for the state of Oregon. In addition, we collect about another $29 million of registration fees on behalf of other jurisdictions. And these fees are paid by Oregon-based motor carriers that are interstate in nature and operate in the other states. We participate in a base state agreement called the IRP, or the International Registration Plan. And through that, motor carriers domiciled in any state deal with their base jurisdiction, and they execute all of their payment responsibilities to the other participating jurisdictions through their base state. We collect in excess of $200 million annually in Oregon weight mile tax, and the number of Oregon-based interstate motor carriers who we service through the IFTA, International Fuel Tax Agreement, and IRP, International Registration Plan based state agreements, approximate about 4,000 motor carriers. We have opened here in Salem a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week registration service center. It operates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We have an opportunity here for motor carriers to contact us via telephones, and we issue credentials and fax them. We receive payments by credit card, and we allow motor carriers to plan for their activities and arrival in Oregon 24 hours a day by dealing with our service center outside normal business hours. This particular staff is also responsible for the issuance of overdimension permits. We issue more than 60,000 single trip permits annually for extra legal movements. About 20,000 continuous operation or annual permits. We maintain road and bridge information that allow us to route these extra dimensional and extra legal vehicles safely through the state. We manage the work of 5 third-party agents who we've contracted with and privatize some of the issuance of the continuous trip permits. And by doing that, we've been able to more efficiently deliver the service to the motor carrier industry and use the remaining staff resources to more efficiently deliver the single trip permits, which require route analysis and more technical analysis. We're very busy with routing heavy loads around fragile bridges and bridges that, with increasing frequency, are evidencing cracks within the state. In this regard, in this particular work unit, I'd also like to highlight what's an exciting new development in the issuance and delivery of registration and permitting products. We have pioneered trucking online. This is one of the first opportunities in state government for citizens to interact with state government over the Internet and to purchase and receive credentials through an electronic commerce transaction. This began in January 2003. We unveiled the opportunity, and it's been progressing. The interest is amazing. We've had requests for participation from well over 500 motor carriers to date, and we're completing hundreds of transactions online, and it only portends to get bigger and better and faster. Moving along to the safety investigations and federal program areas, this is 39 staff members that are located throughout the state, and their chief responsibility and duty is to enforce state and federal safety rules regarding the mechanical condition of trucks and the qualifications of drivers. Also, securement of cargo and hazardous cargo shipping requirements. These folks inspect trucks at weigh stations and along the roadside. This staff is responsible for managing the Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program, or MCSAP, federal grant, through which we receive just under $5 million per biennium in base grant dollars. And those dollars are generally used to contract with law enforcement agencies all across the state to assist us in truck and driver safety regulation work. The staff also conducts comprehensive audits of trucking companies at their terminals, and we train and certify all inspectors that perform truck and or driver inspections across the state. That's a statutory requirement. And upon request, the staff will also assist the Oregon State Police in responding to and investigating truck accidents. The staff is responsible also for the day-to-day management of what is known as the Green Light Way Station Pre-Clearance System. I'm sure most of you are familiar with that. This is the use of intelligent transportation technology to check electronically and at full freeway speeds the status of trucks as they're passing by our way stations and ports of entry. And trucks that pass the various regulatory checks are signaled via an in-cab device called a transponder and given a green light and allowed to go right on by an open way station. Today in Oregon, there are just over 2,300 motor carriers that participate in green light, and all told, over 23,000 trucks are equipped with transponders. In a recent month, actually, over 50% of all the weighings that took place at one of our busy way stations, port of entry, the Woodburn southbound station, were actually done through the green light system. And the interesting thing about green light, traffic has increased. The original design specifications for the southbound Woodburn port of entry, as an example, anticipated 2,500 trucks a day flowing through the facility. And today we're seeing well over twice that, almost 5,500 trucks flowing through the facility. And you can imagine that the trucks with that kind of unanticipated volume back up the approach runway and used to back right up onto the freeway and block the right-hand lane of the freeway. So the state was posed this interesting choice. It could purchase additional right-of-way. It could put in additional static weight platforms. It could build a bigger way station. It could hire more staff to operate that bigger way station. Or we could use the technology that Greenlight provides. Greenlight, at the speed of the freeway traffic, does every regulatory check that an officer would perform had the truck pulled into the way station. We look at registration, highway use tax status, whether or not they're current and paid up. We look at their weight. We look at their height. We look at safety. And we do everything in a fraction of a second, and a safe and legal truck is allowed to bypass. It represents significant cost avoidance opportunities for the state. I'll move on to the field motor carriers.
Oh, yes, Senator Carter.
So is that a part of your 070 packet? Does any of these services impact that? Okay, I'll wait till you get to that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'll move on then to, lost my place. I'll move on to the field motor carrier services section. And I described that in my opening remarks as a staff that's responsible for size and weight enforcement across the state. I've got approximately 97 officers. They're located across the state. They work at 81 fixed way stations, 6 ports of entry, and dozens of portable scale sites located all around the state. Today, their current focus is increasingly dedicated to working to protect fragile bridges that are emerging. But this staff is predominantly responsible for weighing trucks and enforcing size regulations. In 2001, they weighed almost 2.5 million trucks on static scales. They wrote over 16,000 citations for weight violations. They wrote almost 24,000 warnings for less than critical violations. And they stopped and required almost 9,000 trucks to legalize and conform to size and weight law. The next section I would speak about is the motor carrier audit section. This staff is located in offices in Portland, Salem, Eugene, and Pendleton. They verify the accuracy of the weight mile tax returns that are submitted by taxpayers. They also audit the registration fee payments and the fuel tax payments through the base states I mentioned previously, IRP and IFTA. In a given year, the staff efforts result in the recovery of just over $500,000. I'm sorry, $5 million of unreported and unpaid wait mile tax through their efforts.
Greg, before you leave that, folks operating on with a farm plate burn fuel that has the federal tax, federal and state tax on it. Does that revenue come through yours, or does it just go straight to fuel taxes?
Straight to fuel tax.
Okay.
I'd like to talk a little bit.
Hansen has
a question. Oh, I'm sorry.
Question on the audit. What percentage of that is done out of state? I guess the bigger question is, do we have a problem with out of state truckers not paying the weight mile in Oregon, or has that been overblown?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I think there's two ways to answer that question. I would characterize the out-of-state motor carrier as tending to be the larger motor carrier that we deal with, as opposed to Oregon-based motor carriers. And so, quite likely, in terms of dollars recovered, we may be recovering greater dollars from out-of-state-based motor carriers. But you pose the question in terms of where there's an audit recovery. Is it numerically? Is it more Oregon-based or is it more foreign-based? Off the top of my head, I would suggest that it's probably evenly split, but the greater dollars probably come from foreign-based motor carriers, and that's a function of size as opposed to domicile.
I guess the follow-up question would be, do we need a branch office in Arkansas?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I would say no. We have the capacity to travel out of state and audit where we deem necessary. We group the trips so that one auditor on an extended, say, 4 to 6 week trip is seeing multiple motor carriers located in a given geographic area, and those travel expenses represent no expense to the state, as the motor carriers, in fact, reimburse us the cost of the auditor travel.
So they will not be affected by the travel tax?
Mr. Chairman, no, they are not impacted by travel tax. With regard to performance measurement, before I actually talk about performance measurement, I'd like to just take a brief detour and talk a little bit about customer service. We routinely conduct customer satisfaction surveys. Well, routinely. We did in 1993, we did in 1998, and we did in 2003 to keep our finger on the pulse of what was transpiring. And as a regulatory agency, we have occasion to engage the trucking industry in sometimes less than cordial circumstances, as an audit can result in a significant tax liability. A safety audit can result in a civil monetary penalty as well as a civil complaint. And so in that kind of a situation, you may expect that we have less than an admirable response from the trucking industry that we regulate. And just the opposite is the case. In a recent survey conducted in 2002, actually, we had an 81% overall approval rating, but couple that with 15% that had no opinion, and only 4% that expressed actual dissatisfaction. And I think that's somewhat remarkable. We did a statistically valid survey. We interviewed 16 customer groups. We had a 31% response rate from 11 surveys sent by mail, and a 17% response rate from 5 surveys handed out at field offices, and still in all had an 81% approval rating. With regard to performance measurement, the division monitors many.
Senator Carter?
I just wanted to add, that's the question I wanted to ask you, and overall. And my question, I just wrote myself a little note here. How will your department fulfill the goals of the overarching goal that the department has in lieu of your using 13 positions? Because of revenue shortfalls in the package 070.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, Thank you for that question. The overarching goals, improve safety, move people and goods efficiently, improve the economy and livability. We, in essence, have taken a very studied look at how we can reduce our service delivery costs while balancing a still acceptable level of customer service delivery, along with the need to be able to divert as much of the highway fund to the road as possible. We have, through Senate Bill 1149, passed out of the 1995 legislature that moved the transportation program from the PUC to ODOT, an advisory committee that was created via a budget note called the Motor Carrier Transportation Advisory Committee. Rather than prescribing to the industry what I'm going to cut or how I'm going to change service delivery, we have used that advisory committee to put the question on the table. It's desirable for us to make as much of the highway fund revenue we generate as available to road and bridges as possible. We need to reduce our costs, our administrative costs, and we do that in partnership with the industry we regulate. In other words, they themselves have suggested to us where they could accept a reduced level of service or where they would prefer that we not reduce service. But probably most importantly, we have made very judicious and studied application of technology since 1995. Greenlight is a significant cost savings. The use of trucking online and the ability to move some of our customers from the telephone and from a service counter to an internet portal has been huge, and I think that that will span the gap for us.
I'm hearing that, Greg. The only thing that I was asking, because you said, on the governor's side, Laurie said, this impacts customer service because there's a shortfall of $1.8 million.
Chair George, Senator Carter. I believe what the division has indicated is there will be some changes in terms of customer service as it's being delivered right now. There will be 13 fewer registration permit analysts. There will be some field offices, I believe, that will be closed. There will be some hours reduced in terms of operation. But I think the division is trying to offset that with some of these other changes. But it is a reduction.
Okay, I just don't want these guys on my back saying, that was your committee, Senator Carter, and we support you, and we're getting less service for our dollar, and I'm trying to find out how you can still give quality service to the truckers and let the bottom line maintain itself, because Oregon is losing enough money as it is, and at the same time, you know, give quality service.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, we have actually already made the office closures that this package speaks to. And we made them during the current biennium. And we specifically closed the registration services office at the Cascade Locks Port of Entry and at the Woodburn Port of Entry. And we did that simultaneously with the opening of the Salem 24-hour-day, 7-day-a-week service center and concurrently with the introduction of trucking online. In essence, we have moved customers from the counter to the telephone and to the internet.
Not notice any reputable harm. Inconvenience, but not reputable harm.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, that's correct.
Okay.
Greg, that might be a good place for us to end for the day.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. I have to tell you that in all of my years of being here, I've never had any group come in that you regulate that are enthusiastic about your department today. I thought that was pretty amazing.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much. With the top of the gavel, we'll be adjourned.